Welcome to the War Report on Public Education. The future of education is an important concern for our time. Where it's heading, how it's evolving, and the influence corporate America has on its outcome. The War Report on Public Education provides critical news, analysis, and perspectives on the what, why, who, where, when, and how of both the new corporate state elites campaign, the Machiavellian agenda to destroy the nation's public education system, and the rising public resistance movement to defend and defeat this Machiavellian agenda. And now, here is our host, Dr. James Abington Miller, Jr.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of the War Report. Okay, it's after Labor Day. Everyone now is back in school, at least from pre-K to 12. Some colleges and universities will be getting back a little later on this month, so it's back to school for most of us. This week, I had one show scheduled, and it didn't sort of like come together. And so I was scrambling, trying to figure out what I could do for this show. And I have been, as you know, I get something on the order of 700 posts a day. And when I'm on the road, of course, I can't get through all of the posts and da-da-da. So now that I'm home, I get a chance to go through more of them in a little more detail. And one of the things that I saw over and over and over again was teachers and a few parents describing what they encountered first day, first few days back in school this year, 2016. And some of the things that I saw, and then there were some good articles talking about this back to school 2016 sort of thing, and I started seeing some dots and start connecting some dots, and I decided this is definitely worth talking about. And so I'm hoping those of you who are in with us now, if you have some stories that you will call in and share your stories with what I'm going to talk about, and that call-in number is 1-888-627-6008. Let me repeat. It's 1-888-627-6008. The first thing that I saw was that children, students coming back to school this year, many will not be greeted by teachers, and especially teachers that they had last year or teachers who have been in the building for a number of years. And the reason is that there's a shortage of teachers. There's a shortage of teachers. It's happening all parts of the country, East Coast, West Coast, South, North, Midwest. Everyone is talking about this. There's a shortage of teachers. What the hell did you expect, given what has been happening to teachers over the last 35 years, and particularly the last 15 years, there's this shortage of teachers. Why is there a shortage of teachers? First of all, they're calling it a crisis. And you know from listening to the War Report that that's the key to the reform movement is crisis. Whenever there is a crisis, you take advantage of it. Now, what they don't say is that there are natural crises like Katrina in New Orleans, and then there's a manufactured crisis, which they deliberately make and then turn around and call it a crisis and blaming the crisis on someone else. But they also have immediate solution. So you create your crisis because you have the solution, but you don't let people know that you created the crisis, you know, the sleight of hand sort of thing. The crisis that we have now is a manufactured crisis. In the literature, we identify these crises, dichotomy in terms of natural versus manufactured. And I'm here saying that the teacher shortage is a manufactured crisis, and guess what? It's right out of the neoliberal playbook, the Machiavellian agenda, to create this crisis. Now, think about this, and teachers and parents, but particularly teachers, you know this. You know this as well as I do, if not even better. Let's look at what I think is now manifesting itself right now in terms of this crisis. For the longest of time, teachers have been blamed for, quote, the lack of high achievement among all students, and then particularly the disparity in achievement between middle class, working class, lower class, minorities, and et cetera. And that it was teachers' fault, it was the school's fault, it was the district's fault, and the way in which to get rid of these disparities is to get rid of the teachers, and you know the rest. So what has happened is there's everything that they could think of to do to not only blame the teachers, but to actually find ways to get rid of teachers and to make the workplace so hostile, so threatening, so intimidating that teachers leave on their own accord. That's the part of the manufacturing part. Then there is austerity. Well, we don't have the money, and so hence we have to start cutting back. We have to start getting rid of things. We get rid of classes, like the arts, you know, arts, the humanities, and et cetera. Well, then you don't need those teachers. We can't give you a raise. We can't do this. Or like in Detroit, we're going to take money from you, and we'll pay you years later, providing you're still working and this condition and that condition, and you force teachers into poverty. You force teachers and having to work multiple jobs, and eventually maybe you force teachers to leave. So there's another way in which you get rid of teachers. Then, like in Chicago, where you say, I'm going to close 50 schools, and you get rid of thousands of teachers. Like in other cities across the country, where urban schools have been taken over, turned around, closed, getting rid of faculty, having faculty have to reapply for positions, and particularly getting rid of thousands, some say tens of thousands, of minority teachers, or teachers of color, and particularly black teachers. And so you have a shortage. And it's areas where population is growing, and you're attacking public schools, and as I said earlier, you're closing them down, you're turning them around, and also the rise of charter schools. We talked about this last week in terms of the growth of charter schools been phenomenal in some areas, with New Orleans being an all-charter district, Chicago attempting to make Chicago an all-charter district, Detroit about on the verge of making Detroit an all-charter district, Flint, Michigan, huge number of charter schools in terms of percentage of total public school sites, and on and on and on. So you have a situation where over the last 15 years, and particularly under Bush 2 and Obama, where the neolibs have gotten their agenda into full gear, and part of that agenda was to get rid of teachers. But there's some more here. You get rid of teachers, and many of those teachers, especially in the Midwest, the North, Northeast, the West, where there are still teachers' unions, you diminish the strength of the union in terms of the number of teachers that are in the union, number of teachers who are paying dues, which in turn affects the union's ability to pump money into political campaigns and et cetera. So you create this shortage, but it has ripple effects. You get rid of teachers, you then diminish the strength of the unions, and on. Now, I could stop right there in terms of trying to connect those dots, but that would be a really incomplete picture. Let's go back to this. The neoliberal agenda, the reformers say, we're into disruption. Because with disruption, people then will have to make changes, people have to do better, and what have you. And I've told you that the original term, going back to the 1930s, when we had the word neoliberalism come into existence, it was destruction. That has always been the intent, the destruction of whatever area that they were seeking to take over. And in this case, it's public education. So we have this whole thing in terms of manufacturing a crisis so that you can destroy, so that you can come back with privatized education. And there are so many ways in which they've gone about this. You know them all, but let's just quickly summarize them in terms of how about one of the latest, and we've talked about this area in which they have gone after public education, public school teachers, is teacher prep programs. You create a shortage, and what do? You turn to Teach for America. What, 25 years they've been in existence now? You turn to Teach for America, who turn out, I want to say five-week wonders. Oh, I just said it. Five-week wonders come into the most needy schools, cities, districts in the state, in the country, with 5 weeks of, quote, preparation, and you plop them into schools because you've created shortage. They come in, they fulfill the shortage. Say a day or two, a week, a month, 2 years, they're gone. Boom. You still have a teacher shortage. Other prep organization, teacher prep organization have come about. We talked about this just a few weeks ago, maybe a couple months ago now, where, again, it's creating teachers to fill the void that was manufactured in the very beginning. So you manufacture this shortage. You can then, boom, plop in unqualified, I'm using the word unqualified, unprepared newbies to come in. And boom, they stay in a short time and they're gone. In some areas where Wisconsin and other states, and particularly this past fall, or we're in the fall now, but this summer and now into the fall, several other states have adopted the idea that you don't even have to have 5 weeks of training. If you have experience in the area where math maybe was used and you know something about math, you can come in and you can teach math as long as you're not a pedophile. That's really kind of close to what the standard is these days in some areas. So that you say, well, we got this shortage. The only way we can fulfill our need is to change the requirements and open teaching up to a whole class of people who are adults, supposedly, I guess 21, must be 21, have learned experience that allow them to come in and teach as experts based upon their job experience over the last 5, 10, 15, 20 years, whatever. So, here you have another dot, I think, that contributes to the teacher shortage. You get your uncertified, you get your unaccredited, and you get people who don't stay. So each year you have a shortage. Another dot. Teachers are being treated so badly these days that the number of college students who would normally go into teaching to be or go into training to become teachers is dropping all across the country. You already know this. People say, you know, why go into teaching? And they're not. So hence, you have another dot here in terms of the shortage. Again, you guys already know this, but when we put it all together, I'm going to propose this, and that is, if this is all manufactured, and if this all springs from the neoliberal agenda, the Machiavellian agenda, I submit that the end game here is what we've been talking about here, for the last 11 months, and that is digital computer-based education, where you don't need teachers. Emily Talmadge, Dr. McDermott, and a few others this past, maybe the last 5 or 6 months, and Emily, for as far as I know, last October 2015, when it came to my attention, when she was writing about proficiency, individual, personalized learning, and what have you, and that her state, Maine, had been one of the testing grounds. Alaska was first, then it was imported to Maine, and that now it's being introduced to many states, and with more on the way. It's pretty much like the Common Core rollout. The intent is to have digitized computer-based education as the norm. You set up all these poor conditions for teachers. You get rid of teachers. You bring in different training approaches for teachers. Teachers, kids are not going into education. This is what is wanted, because at the end of the tunnel is going to be Apple or a PC sitting there with software created by all the players and students sitting right in front of their computers, or they get their laptops to take home, and you don't need teachers per se. You need lab techs. You need someone to walk around, make sure that the computer is working right and the students are learning how to use it, and they work on the modules, and you can't go any further until you get this particular module correctly mastered, and that's determined by the computer itself, whether you do master it or not, before you can move on. What I'm saying here, folks, is that, yes, today, this week, last week, week before that, when students arrived at their schools, they were greeted by fewer teachers than the year before, the year before, the year before, the year before, the year before. And that they will be probably greeted by fewer teachers next year, the year after that, the year after that, because I believe the end game is in sight. People are being told that the computer-based learning is the most efficient. And use that word efficient because, remember, that's part of the neoliberal ideology, is efficiency. And that, one, after you lay out the money for the computers, the software, the internet connection, your costs won't be that much because it's a computer and you don't need teachers who have vacation days, who have sick days, who have health insurance coverage in many places, who have summer vacation, Christmas vacation, personal leave. You don't have any of that. So, yes, kids this fall were greeted by fewer teachers, and it's going to get worse. Another thing that caught my eye was I just tied two things together, basically the teacher shortage and the digital nightmare curriculum. You already know about this in terms of we're going digital in terms of the curriculum itself and the delivery of the curriculum via the computer. So that's already in the works. Another thing that caught my eye, and I almost said it with a smile, but then again, I know it's really happening, and it's sad as hell. There was a piece that I saw that talked about teachers having to work for Uber just to keep a foothold in the middle class. I didn't know anything about Uber until last fall. I think it was the first road trip, for sure the second trip, that there was this thing called Uber. It's like a taxi service. You guys know about it. I really don't know it like I should probably need to know it, but Uber. And what Uber is a new business model where you don't have employees, where everyone who works, who drives, who picks up people are independent. They bring their own car. I'm assuming they have to have their own insurance because you have to have insurance to have the car and on. And they are dispatched to pick up a person via the computer, and the fare is based on some formula that makes it a whole lot cheaper than your regular cab companies all across the country, and that particularly young people are just giddy over Uber and Metro, Omega Bus, and people like this. And so this business model is catching on all across the country, except in those cities where the unions have been able to keep them from coming in. I know places in New York, the state of New York, and on and on. And so when I saw this article, it really caught my eye that teachers are having to go to places like Uber for a second job and maybe even for a third job. But backing up, we know for the past so many years that many teachers across the country have had to take second jobs, even third jobs. And this is during the school year when they're teaching full-time, and for sure during the summer when they're not getting paid. But what made this interesting to me, as well as sad, is that Uber here on the West Coast, in the northern part of California, and particularly near the area or in the area of what is called Silicon Valley, where all the tech giants, not say almost the majority of the tech giants are based, Silicon Valley. That's why they call it Silicon. That here was a teacher, a man, and his wife is also a teacher. California, we're not the highest paid teachers in this country, but we're a lot better than some regions like the South and what have you. But here are these two teachers, middle class, I'm going to guess probably pulling in for sure a six-figure income. The guy has to go to Uber because in Silicon Valley, where the average worker could be making six-figure income and $200,000, $300,000, they are buying up all the real estate in that area so that workers have to move further and further from their job as far away as, say, the city of San Francisco, so that people who have a standard, because I don't know what a standard middle class income is anymore, but people who are making $80,000, $90,000 years ago, that was a cool income. You could buy your house, the car, vacation, prepare to send the kids to college, and et cetera. Now, this couple, they can't even afford to live in their neighborhood anymore. And here's the kicker. Uber advertised profusely that many of their drivers are teachers. I'm hesitating because I want that to sink in. It has become a marketing tool that our drivers are teachers. They are from the community. They are upstanding people in the community. And you're most likely going to get a teacher as your driver, and on and on and on. That to me was, it was hilarious until it began to really sink in a little bit here that the problem is so great at Uber, and I guess any other company as well, is capitalized on it by marking it as a way to distinguish itself from the competition. Our drivers are teachers. I don't know how that was working, but that caught me. So this is something that teachers across the country, again, are coming into this fall with. In districts, in states where teachers are woefully underpaid, teachers are threatened with losing their jobs, teachers are becoming so targeted for speaking up, speaking out about conditions in their schools, conditions in their district, who are complaining about the draconian atmosphere which they have to work in, that they're losing their jobs. And those who manage to keep their jobs, many of them are showing up with anxiety, depression, all stress, you name it. And some are financially impaired now to the point where they got to have that second or third job. And in talking about all of this, think about this, at least I would like for you to think about this, and that is, 2016, how does it compare to 2015? And if you were around 2010, and if you were around even before that, 2005? Is the situation getting worse? Is the situation now affecting more and more teachers each year or less? That's something I want you to think about. Another thing that really got to me was the idea that the government, well, I won't say got to me. This was sort of like a sort of welcoming thing that for the kids coming into school this year. Federal government just, was it last week, put out some guidelines for having cops in schools. And I think that's a good thing. And they're telling, just like they did with the school-to-prison pipeline, they put out guidelines earlier this year because it was finally recognized that there were hundreds and then thousands and then tens of thousands of students across the country are being suspended, being put out of school, calling cops to come get students for the, you name it, really minor thing, booking them, taking them to the precinct, and starting introducing them to the criminal justice system and some of this crap started with kids in preschool. And I mentioned this to one of my neighbors when I came back from either the second or this last trip, that there were kindergartens who were put in handcuffs and placed in police cars and taken to the precinct. The guy actually able to call me a liar. That was the most ridiculous thing you'd ever heard. I almost got offended, but I didn't. I just chalked up to ignorance. I knew what I was talking about. He didn't. But they came out with guidelines. Now they are saying that we need to have more thoughtful guidelines in terms of should we even have police, cops in schools, and if you do, what should be their function, and the violence that we're seeing in schools perpetrated by police on unarmed students, young students, women, girls, what have you, definitely has to be curtailed. So that was something that I thought was very interesting, and it came right at the time that school was getting ready to start in some parts of the country. A whole different area, and this to me was very interesting. Again, I'm talking about things that, one, we probably should already know as relates to what's been happening over the last decade and a half, and that many of the things that we have learned about are actually still happening today, 2016, and some new things. But here was an area that got my attention, and that is there is this concern now about black male teachers. They're leaving the teaching profession in large numbers all across the country, almost like Teach for America folks. And different reasons, of course, but one of the reasons that the black male teachers give for leaving, I can identify with, and I'll explain that in a moment. And it's this, that they become the go-to disciplinarian at their schools. they become part of the process that could end up having kids suspended, end up having kids put out of school and have to seek alternative schools. They become part of the process of initiating the school-to-prison pipeline. And for many of these male teachers, it's beginning to bother them. And I know something about that. The time that I was a sub, and I've explained to you guys before that in grad school in Detroit, I was a sub for about a year, year and a half. And every school that I went to, once I got there and the principals and other teachers saw that, quote, I was very good at classroom management, that they didn't have to run to my rescue and et cetera, and the kids weren't going bananas and what have you, I became the sub of preference. Teachers and principals would call me direct. They would bypass the automated system where you call in as a sub saying that you're available, and then the machine would pick you and send you all here, there, what have you. Teachers and principals would call me directly, and then sometimes teachers and principals would say, next month, Mrs. Jones is going to be out this week, and then so-and-so, that they were long-term planning with me being their sub because I was a male teacher who could manage my classroom. Those kids who were disruptive, I handled. Those kids who were disruptive in other classrooms, I'm a sub, and they would send those kids to me. And especially if I was going to be there 3, 4, 5 days and et cetera, I became the disciplinarian. And that happened when I was in Detroit. I subbed a short time in California here, and I did full-time teaching, and I told you about this, the 1 year at an elementary school, and it happened there to the point where when I first came in, the principal saw me as a person to be the resource teacher because of my background and da-da-da-da, so I would be over here, I would be over there, I'd be what have you. One of the fifth grade teachers, school went to up to the kindergarten to fifth grade, male, black teacher, set up and decided, I'm retiring. I'm not going to wait till the end of the year. I'm retiring. There were two female teachers who had been there as long-term subs for several years, and there was me. The principal, the vice principal, the president or the parent association, what have you, they all wanted me to take this fifth grade class as opposed to the people who had been there much longer and et cetera, because I had established the fact that, one, I could, well, it was disciplinary, yes, but I could also relate to all the kids from kindergarten all the way up to fifth grade, and that there were some kids in this class that would give these other teachers, they thought, fits. So they wanted me. So I'm, again, put in that disciplinarian role. Yes, it does wear on you. Yes, it does become psychologically a problem. So I could see these guys, depending on where they were and how often they were put in that position as being the disciplinarian, and that they, in turn, were part of the problem in terms of putting kids in the school-to-prison pipeline, having kids put out of school, period. And so this is, again, maybe it was just personal because I've been there, done that sort of thing, but to identify this as one of the major reasons, if not the number one reason, these black male teachers are leaving teaching. Really caught my eye, really resonated with me. And I don't know if the situation is so bad that it would cause the few black male teachers that there are in education to leave in great numbers. Would be nice to hear from some of you teachers about this, because it's something that's happening, according to this article, in great numbers. So that was of interest to me and all. And then there was another thing that caught my attention, because it too dealt with race. And that is that there is, according to a lot of people now, that the rising struggle to make black education matter all of a sudden. I don't say all of a sudden, because there are those of us whose black education has mattered forever, for hundreds of years. In fact, one of my projects that I collected data on while I was on this last road trip, and a little bit of the second road trip, is what I call my 400-year struggle for black education. And I think I've mentioned it a little bit on air, where I look at going all the way back to when Africans were put into chained on the west coast of Africa and eventually put on ships across the Atlantic, what's known as the Middle Passage, and then delivered to South America and then eventually to the colonies, that was, for all of them, the beginning of a struggle for education. The education then was the education to survive, just survive being captured and kidnapped and struggling to understand what's happening, but more importantly, understand how to survive that horrendous event. And then the Middle Passage. I don't know if any of you really know about any of this, but the slaves, when the Africans were captured, or when they were by either other Africans and sold to the Europeans, and then when the Europeans started moving inland and capturing slaves, kidnapping Africans and then turn them into slaves, they brought them to the coastline, and then they were sold, and then they were put on ships, and these ships were horrendous, of course, and then they were transported from west coast of Africa all the way over to Brazil, mostly, but to South America. That third, maybe even 40%, 50% did not survive the Middle Passage. Those who did, it was because they were able to learn. They were able to learn the skills needed to survive that Middle Passage. To me, that was an education. There was a struggle there. And then when it got to South America, they underwent a formal education process called seasoning, where you were taught to be, and you had to learn to be a slave for life. And then on and on and on and on throughout the 400-year presence here. And so, and then, of course, we know about the 1954 Supreme Court decision outlawing segregation, and we know about the struggle for equality. We know about the struggle for equal schooling opportunities, particularly in the South, where you had separate but unequal, and you have schools where minority students go, get less funding, resourcing, et cetera. But this particular series of stories here was basically saying that through what's happening now in terms of the reform movement, the war, and other things that are happening, the country now is beginning to own the charter schools and the voucher programs, you name it, that the rest of the country is beginning to become aware of Black education matters. I did a, and you know, I don't know anything about current technology and the Facebook and Twitter and what have you, but I actually, over a year, year and a half ago, did a thing, set up a Twitter account on Black Education Matter. Never used it, but I set it up. But now it is something that is happening in terms of actually getting a large, large segment of the population's attention outside of the Black community that Black education matters. And so that went with the fact that, I said earlier, Black male teachers are leaving the profession. And then another, and this again, I was really surprised, there was another series of stories and research and et cetera dealing with Afrocentric education crisis that many, when I say many, I don't have a number, but a lot of the charter schools in the urban areas came into existence, and because they were saying they were going to offer an Afro-American-centric curriculum, teaching, and et cetera. And this is why they were going to be different. This is why they were going to be better than the public schools that were there before and who were still standing. And there were a lot of these schools, granted, charters, and et cetera. Well, we're finding that many of those schools didn't do not any better. They didn't do as good as the public schools was doing in terms of educating Black students with their, quote, ethnocentric curriculum and teaching style and all. And it's now becoming, quote, a crisis that many of these schools are going to be shut down. And, you know, people don't like to have their charter schools shut down, but this is happening. And something that, of course, I'll be watching, but kids are coming back to school to find that their charter schools that offer this, whatever this, I don't want to say whatever, like I don't know what it is, but I'm not a total, I'm not a proponent of the ethnocentric total curriculum. And so to see that this is not working, and I don't know why, because I haven't looked at it per se, but it's to the point where it's a crisis and that other people are looking at it. And then there was one last Black emphasis that caught my attention, and that is that Black kids, Black teachers, Black schools are hurting. Like, this is a major revelation. Not to me, it's not to you. But they are finding that, like Detroit, they're hurting. But one solution, and this is where I'm getting to, some people in Detroit are attempting to resurrect a schooling model that came out of the civil rights movement of the 50s and the 60s. And these are called freedom schools. In the 60s, in the South, the freedom schools, or I should say the a lot of the students coming from the North and et cetera, as well as from the South, they, under the leadership of some people, they got this idea of establishing their own schools. They weren't funded by the state or what have you. They were basically funded by the community, like the schools were right after the close of the Civil War during the Reconstruction period. And they taught the basics, basically reading and then writing and then fundamentals of math and all. But they also provided a sort of like an emotional haven for the students, a psychological component. Boy, my time has gone really quickly. I didn't realize that we're out of time almost, folks. But anyway, Freedom Schools. And a friend of mine, the person who became a friend, and I went to Detroit the first time as well as the second time, Dr. House, Gloria House, she was a person who was one of the teachers in the Freedom Schools back in the mid-60s and afterwards. She's a professor at one of the universities. I think she's retired now. She has been pushing, bringing back the Freedom School concept. I was at several meetings with her and others when they were talking about the Freedom School. They're actually getting it going now in Detroit on a very, very small scale. So since I'm out of time, I'll just say this. Race has finally been recognized as one of the principal drivers of this war on public education, and that we are seeing it now in many, many different manifestations. And one last thing is that higher education, the war on higher education is picking up, and I will talk about that at a later point because I really want to get to that. But in summary, what I'm saying is coming back to school 2016, I think it's worse than it was 2015, 2014, and et cetera. And I think all of it is the result of manufactured crisis, not natural crisis or phenomena. And all of it is being driven by the neoliberal Machiavellian agenda. And with that, I'm going to have to stop because my time is up. I spent too much time on the other areas. I'm sorry about that. It's also Football Sunday, folks. For those of us who are football fans, have a good Sunday watching football. And for everyone else, have a great Sunday. See you next week.
Join us again next time as we explore and become aware of the most pressing problem of our time, education, corporate America, and their unholy alliance.